Hello there. You are listening to Revenue Insights. This week, I've been speaking with Kristen Haybutt. She's the Chief Revenue Officer over at Typeform. Kristen's journey has taken her from working with some big PLG giants from Trello to Atlassian to Shogun. And today, she's working as both CRO and Enterprise Sales Leader at Typeform. Throughout the conversation, we obviously talked a lot about product-led growth motions, talked about the singular funnel that they use at Typeform. We also spent a lot of time talking about what Kristen refers to as zero-party data, which essentially is the signals and insights that they're taking from their product and using them to inform the product-led qualification of leads, but also how they're weaving those insights to create a far more powerful, effective, and valuable sales motion. I think you'll really enjoy this one.
Welcome to Revenue Insights. Every week, we'll be joined by revenue leaders from some of the most successful and highest growing companies. Together, we explore how they built their revenue teams, the journeys that they've been on, and the lessons they have learned along the way. Revenue Insights is brought to you by Ebster. We're a revenue intelligence platform designed to help revenue teams to build more pipeline, close more deals, and retain more customers.
Kristen, hello, welcome. And how are you?
Hi, great. How are you doing?
Very, very good. And very excited actually coming into this to explore your journey. Previously, Trello, Atlassian, Shogun, I think it was, and now Typeform. I am fascinated to kind of, it feels like you've got a lot of specialist expertise, particularly around PLG, that I'm excited to dig into. But without me kind of giving away too much of the story, what has been your journey to get to where you are today?
Yeah. I mean, I seemingly stumbled into sales, and I've been fortunate enough to always be in companies that ultimately took on a PLG motion, whether purposefully or not. I think before the word actually existed, we were doing that motion quite a bit. So I started off in managed security software sales, and then I was selling to financial institutions in the market, and the US crashed right around then. A bunch of the banks we were selling to went out of business, and I ended up finding a job at Fog Creek Software, which, if anybody is tech people, knows that was Joel Spolsky and Michael Pryor's company that then later spun off Stack Exchange and Trello and all these other cool things. And they were very much engineers first, and they wanted to build a tool that people could find and use and take advantage of without having to engage with salespeople. And so they sort of reluctantly hired the first couple of salespeople to, I think, half jokingly kind of prove that they were right, that they didn't need us, and half see if it actually would accelerate things. And that was really the start of sort of living in this PLG land. And so between working with them and then later working at another company called Awareness Technologies that was very self-serve business, really small sales team only to enterprise, everything else came through. Then back to Trello once they'd spun it out, then to the Atlassian. It all kind of ended up being these themes of what we now call PLG, but ultimately I think of it as like really putting people in the right place in the process, right? Like making sure the buyer journey made the most sense. If you don't need to talk to somebody, you don't have to. If it makes sense, then you do. And so I sort of accidentally stumbled into it and then made a career out of doing it. And at this point, I'm super passionate about it because I think when you look at things with a PLG lens and you think about where the human element of a go-to-market team can accelerate you, and you think about where those two things can help each other at, that's really where you get these magical growth businesses and these magical customer experience journeys and the things that usually most people think of as this like delightful buying experience.
Amazing. I completely agree. And I think it would be wonderful to kind of get in your words that we kind of talked about kind of pre-show and coming into the conversation today. I think to your point, like so many fall into this by chance. And naturally, it sounds like you kind of found something that really aligned to you as an individual and ultimately you as a leader as well. And something that we were talking about before the show was this idea of like a single flywheel. And I guess in my words, a single motion.
Yeah.
So can you, I guess, perhaps talk more generally to begin with around what that is at Typeform and kind of an overview of how that works.
Yeah, so I like to call this looking at things through one funnel. You could look at it from a flywheel, which Atlassian always kind of termed the flywheel. But the idea basically comes down to looking at your customer journey holistically and putting people through the journey in an intelligent way, meaning like the way that they would buy or they would engage versus putting up these false processes. And so an example would be, because you're XYZ sized company, you don't have the opportunity to self-serve. You don't have the opportunity to test and buy on your own. You have to go through our enterprise funnel. And so we have this enterprise funnel, we have this self-serve funnel, we have this maybe ecosystem funnel. And the idea is that we've made these predetermined decisions about you as a buyer, and we've put you into those journeys. But just because I happen to work at a Fortune 500 company doesn't mean that I want to talk to a salesperson, that I need to talk to a salesperson, or that I need them in that part of the journey. Maybe I will need them at a different part of the journey. And so when I think about looking at it through this lens of one funnel, I think about, listen, you want to get everybody in, and then you want to start having these selection moments for them where they would say, I want to start the trial. I want assistance before I start the trial. I've gotten this far in the trial, maybe self-serve usage, maybe certain triggers are set off then that would put me to a sales engineer or to a partner or looking at it from that. But it's all coming from this lens of one journey that then has different kind of exits that people could take. And that in and of itself, I don't think is necessarily super revolutionary. But even when people say that they want to do that, what you actually then find out is that in theory, that's how their funnel looks, but their sales team is actually isolated from a bunch of that. They can't see product qualified leads. They can't see marketing qualified leads, maybe even. They can only see what's been passed through to them or what they're going to outbound to. And so in practice, the funnel is actually still very much segmented. Sometimes customer success isn't in the revenue team. Sometimes sales and marketing are not in the same work together, share the same goals together. So even when you think you've created this journey for your customer that's through a single funnel lens, in practice, it often kind of falls down. And so what we've done at Typeform is really taken that lens and said, how can we get these pieces as close together, whether it's through internal tooling, making sure those systems talk together, whether it's through org structure, whether it's through shared goaling, but how do we actually try to create a funnel that someone can come through in the most intelligent way, allowing them to buy when they want to buy or talk to somebody when they want to talk to them.
It makes total sense to me, and I'm kind of visualizing it, I guess, as you talk. And I suppose what jumps out to me that I'd love to dig into a little bit more around that, you were kind of touching on some businesses that kind of think that they have a singular funnel, but actually they've kind of got multiple ones. What would you say, within the Typeform kind of environment and in your role, how are you ensuring that is that singular funnel? And what are some of the potential pitfalls that you see of when it potentially starts to veer away?
Yeah. I think a good example that I can share from the Typeform experience is Typeform is a product-led growth company. You can go, you can start a Typeform right now without talking to anybody. You can buy it, you can expand all on your own right throughout the journey. But then we also do have an enterprise tier, right? That's very much like, hey, if you're a big company that wants single sign-on, that wants power features, da, 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 da. So before I joined, there was a motion that was really trying to just find those folks for the enterprise. And what hadn't been looked at yet was, what do we know about the customer from what they've told us? It was very much like, oh, let's go and pull Fortune 500 people. It was the standard how you pull an enterprise tier, which isn't wrong, by the way. It's not like anybody did it incorrectly before. But we're also a company that happens to have a bunch of data already about their customers because they're already in it. And plus, we're a company that our product is to ask questions of our customers. We also have a lot of zero-party information about them directly from them. And this is a good example of like, not necessarily intuitively thinking to pull all those pieces together before you start randomly outbounding, but to say, of our existing customer base, who meets those enterprise criteria? Fine. What is their product usage look like? Have they turned on certain integrations? Have they done certain triggers? And that's how you start to build out that product qualified lead motion. And then you combine all that with what do we know about them from what they've told us? What did they say in their onboarding journey? What have they said all through basically submissions they gave us about those insights? And using that to create a lead scoring metric or a product qualified lead scoring metric or an outbound list or a targeted list. And so the way that you would think about that, that involves you've got customer success involved now, you've got product involved now, you've got the data team involved now, and then you've got all of your revenue operations team, plus, of course, your product marketing team. So that's truly looking at that journey and saying, how do you involve all those parts of the funnel? That's hard. So it's like where it goes wrong and where I think people will hit those friction points is it struggled to get buy-in from all those people. They struggled to get time with marketing for that because marketing's doing MQLs or they struggle, you know, it's like you can imagine there's a million places where you would struggle to get buy-in. And so that's where having those shared goals where we say, listen, if we're building X amount of pipeline, hey, marketing, X amount of that's coming from MQLs, but X amount of it's coming from PQLs and X amount of it is coming from this or that. And making sure that those goals are then not just set and shared, but then resourced obviously appropriately as well. And everything has those trade-offs that have to be made.
Just a quick reminder, and then we will be right back to the show. At Revenue Insights, our goal is to share how top-performing revenue leaders build predictable, efficient go-to-market teams. Every week, we speak to the brightest minds, and every quarter, we release the latest findings from our analysis of billions of dollars in pipeline. If you don't want to miss out, sign up to our newsletter at ebster.com/newsletter-signup. That's ebster.com/newsletter-signup. The link to make that a little bit easier for you will be in the show notes of this episode, wherever you're listening. See you there.
I love it, particularly coming from having talked to so many RevOps folks on the show, this idea of aligning all teams together behind a common goal. And what was coming up for me that I'm interested to dig into, and I wonder whether it's easier to kind of explain this through maybe an example, but
yeah,
could you perhaps give an example of maybe over the last 12 months, a new workflow that you wanted to design and perhaps what the thought process is from the CRO's perspective of how you go about implementing that? Because what I'm hearing kind of listening to you is you begin with the objective. Perhaps that's from your data analysis. You can see that there is an opportunity here if we go and do X, Y, and Z. I'll hand over to you at this point to kind of take it from there. But what does that look like?
I mean, I think we can use the PQL example as a good one, which is, hey, we want to spin up a product qualified lead motion because we know that we have 100,000+ customers. And we know that inside of that group, there's a subsegment of those people that are ideal for us to have an upmarket conversation with versus us going out into the world and trying to convince somebody who doesn't even have familiarity with Typeform. So you start by saying, what would we know about these people? What triggers do we have? And so then you start to dig out this PQL motion. But when we start to dig out a PQL motion, you also, I had my customer success team wanting to overhaul their health metrics to say if existing accounts were healthy. So all of a sudden you realize that a lot of what would indicate a healthy account is also what would indicate a potential account for an upsell. So we had these two work streams that weren't talking to each other, right? CSM was running their health score metrics. Sales was trying to run a PQL. And they both had all these dependencies on different teams. And I think that was a good example of just saying like, hey, turns out what you guys are doing on the Venn diagram has this massive overlap. Can we spin this up as a singular project that's basically this like health indicator project? And the health indicator project has a layer of it that has like it's pre-health almost. Like, hey, these folks indicate they are on the track to being a healthy style account for this. That would trigger a sales journey. This one triggers a CSM journey. And by consolidating that streamline, all of a sudden we, instead of people running around trying to fix this ad hoc with individual pieces, they were solutioning it holistically. It was faster. It was easier. People understood how the pieces connect better. And then when you go to do the tooling piece of it, which is to send it to Salesforce, to send it to Catalyst, to send it to wherever, we had our RevOps team who had already been plugged in on all of these pieces and they understood how they were going to build it out instead of finding out how they're going to build out for Salesforce and then step all the way back and say, okay, well, now how do we build it out to send it to Catalyst? Okay, now how do we make Catalyst and Salesforce talk together? So again, having that centralized tooling piece throughout the whole project instead of being brought in, which RevOps sometimes does kind of at the end, really helped as well. So I don't know if that answered your question, but it kind of like that's, I think, how I went about with that specific one and how I think it could have gone sideways very easily if, for example, customer success wasn't part of the same org as revenue, or even if they're not part of the same org, they're not actively talking about it. Because here were two projects, two different parts of the funnel that ultimately were the same project if you looked at it holistically.
Absolutely does answer the question. And I suppose what I'm curious by then is how do you, when you've seen that and you've brought the teams together and they've worked on it, how do you then go about, without the, I guess the obvious answer, but how do you ensure that you measure the effectiveness of that? Because you kind of see the opportunity and can see this just makes sense for us to be more efficient here. But I'm guessing in how you approach, you also want to make sure that, you know, by spending time and resource on it, that actually we're seeing it have an impact on the overall, you know, KPIs of the business.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think for this project, it's probably a little bit more straightforward, right? Because we're directly talking about, there's kind of three core metrics that this would impact. One would be pipeline. PQLs would either generate the pipeline they're expected to or not. And you've kind of done the data research to provide that insight. The other one would be retention on the health metric, which is if we could get better health metrics ahead of time, we could get ahead of churn. And then the third one would be expansion, right? By knowing what people are using in the product and what they said they were coming here to use and saying like, well, if you said you were here for customer acquisition use case and you're not using the HubSpot integration, but we know you're a HubSpot customer, here's an opportunity for us to come in and both rectify what you told us and rectify what we know about you from the tool and put those two together. So that's zero party and third party kind of coming together. And that'll help retention and expansion. That one's easy. I think the harder ones come when we start to talk about a brand campaign or those social things that sometimes don't have as easy of, hey, we put this in because we're expecting X million in revenue from it. Other ones where it's like, well, this influences things. I mean, those are the harder ones. This one, thankfully, I guess is easier because it's directly tied as a revenue initiative.
Makes total sense. And I suppose where I wanted to take us now, you mentioned it earlier with zero party data, I think as you call it. What role does that play in your singular funnel?
Yeah. For me, I think I've realized in the last couple of years that I'm just surprised how little, especially in PLG, we know about our customers directly from them. And even if I think back on my time with Trello and some of the other things, we would have so many, this is the trade-off with PLG, right? You have so many people coming in the door. Not that that's a bad thing, but, and they're almost never being talked to by a salesperson. That's the nature of PLG. You let people in, they come in, they experiment with your tool, they find you from other places, da 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 da. And oftentimes, because you don't have a salesperson, you don't know all the BANT things, right? You don't know, like, what's your need? Are you the right person who should be using it? And so that's the trade-off that PLG gives you. You have that big opportunity, but you have a lot less insights. And so I think back early days of Trello, when we used to be trying to just straight up figure out who these people were, where they came from, why they were using it, and we weren't asking, which I'm sure we would have gotten to in a level of maturity, but we weren't asking. And even now when I talk to other sales leaders, I'll often say like, hey, what's your product onboarding journey? How do you know what people are there for? And especially if you're more of a horizontal tool, a lot of times the answer is very squishy. Like they kind of know, kind of don't, think it's this, not quite sure. And so for us, a lot of what we do, no surprise, obviously it's our tool. This is what we believe in, but it's asking those questions, right? When you come in, there's a type form. It asks you what you're here for. It asks you what you're trying to accomplish. And so that zero party, what I give you directly information is really important for us. It tells us what you want ultimately. And then that's why I was saying you combine it with those other things you know. So you know, if going back to that customer acquisition, if I know you're here to do lead generation or customer acquisition, I can use something like a Clearbit or some other tool like that to know that you're also a Salesforce customer or a HubSpot customer. I can use ecosystem data with Crossbeam and our partners to understand something. I don't have to ask all of those questions, but when I know this one piece about you and I can combine it with those other pieces, that lets us understand not just PQL and health. That allows us to understand what the best onboarding journey is for you, what integration should we highlight? Which one should we de-emphasize? Which pieces should we make sure you're using? If you're here for lead generation and you're a D2C company, you probably care a lot about your brand. Have you used this tool for brand kit? Have you used whatever? So it's really a huge starting off point for us. And it's also a piece we continually lean into in terms of like when we're releasing new features, when we're doing customer service, when we're trying to do it as best as we can. And I think that's where you try to do that at scale, because you're not going to have enough customer success people to have all those questions answered directly or enough salespeople. So it's a big part for us. And it's something I still think, I think AI is going to play a big part in this too, because asking the question is one thing. Aggregating that data and getting those insights from it, which I'm sure anybody listening to will say that's a whole different thing, right? Honestly, most of the time people's problem is either not asking, B, they ask and they just can't find where it went. It's in some tool, this tool doesn't talk to this tool. That's the other big challenge with that part of creating that journey.
Yeah, these are happy problems, having too much data. Usually it's one or the other.
Yeah.
And I think I'll actually come back to that point, but to pick up on something that you mentioned earlier. Now, I would can only imagine, but if I was a salesperson being given almost a PQL handed through where I've got all of this context on, we've already identified like the pain, we've already enriched it with data so we understand the technographics, we know that it's ICP, fantastic.
Right, yep.
What does it look like from there for a salesperson? Because I suppose in many ways, because of that approach and because of the data that you're able to gather on a contact, and obviously the fact that they're already using the product, what does the sales motion then look like for a salesperson to be like, it's almost like an alert's going off of, you know, here is a qualified lead, time to reach out.
Yeah. I think this is the other, again, like any motion has a flip side to the coin. I think this is a lot of times the other challenge with PLG. To some extent, enterprise or sales-led sales motions can be very similar. It's really getting in, making sure you have the right person, asking the right questions around their point, pain point, obviously proving the value, standard stuff. When you're in a PLG motion, you lose a lot of ground in a sales process. You gain a lot and you lose a lot, right? You lose oftentimes that timing piece. They already are a customer to some extent. Like, unless there's this really, I've hit a limit. Like, I needed X amount of responses and I run out of those responses. I needed X amount of boards, I run out of that. Things like that. Like, those are different. It's honestly a much easier sales cycle then, because they're like, I'm locked out. And you're like, all right. But when it becomes something more a consolidation play, that was common in Atlassian, right? Hey, you have a bunch of these pockets of tooling. How do we get you to have a centralized tool? That's very much an IT conversation oftentimes. That's very much a security conversation or a scale conversation or a cost conversation. Sometimes it would be, you're using these things and we know you're using, again, I'll go back to Atlassian, where would it be like, you're using Jira, but you're using Zendesk. Have you thought about using Jira's IT? And that becomes more of a traditional sales motion. So I think within these, it really depends. So even at Typeform, it can be a combination of, I run out of my responses, I'm hitting this blocker, but then it can be, have you thought about using video as a component of this? We know you're using this kind of use case. Let me show you that. So what happens is, in my very roundabout way of answering, which is, at least I've experienced this, it's less out of the box templatized from a sales process. It is a little bit more like, you have to see what brought them there as an MQL. You have to see what brought them there as a PQL. And maybe there's six or seven things that are the same, but it's not one straight sales process with one straight moment of signing with an upgrade journey where you've got a 30-day trial and that 30-day trial is ticking out and either you're on or you're off at the end of this. Because in theory, you could go through that whole sales process and then they buy the self-serve business plan. There's not necessarily a guarantee. So you lose a little bit of that, like, hey, what does it look like? It doesn't always look the same ultimately for every person, which is hard from a training and enablement and a coaching. You really have to have folks who are very kind of quick on their feet in these journeys.
Which kind of leads on to the question that I was going to ask. Does that mean you look for a different type of rep? So often I will speak to sales leaders about the type of folks that they're hiring. It's often I want someone that's curious, I want someone with grit, I want someone with empathy. In given what you've just shared, do you look for any kind of different like values or qualities in a rep?
Yeah, yeah. You hire differently at different phases, right? I think when I was hiring at Trello, which was basically we had no revenue yet, to when I was hiring at Atlassian, to when I'm hiring at Typeform, which I think those are three very different staged companies. You obviously are always hiring different depending on the stage. But the one thing that I've kind of consistently looked for is folks who can live in a gray space. Like being curious and all that, super important, obviously, but it's also the ability to live in a gray space. And what I have found, and this is not by any means like this is always the case, when folks have only been at a company or a series of companies that are very large, very well established based on their name. So think about being at some place like a Salesforce or even now, honestly, probably an Atlassian, but some of those places where like the name and the process and you have teams of teams to help you. And I've had some great folks come from all those different places, but usually it's because they've had a mix. They've been at places like that and smaller and less established. And so I look for people who kind of have that variety of background and who can live in that gray space. But the other one that's honestly, I find pretty consistently is not a good fit for this is if you've done true enterprise sales. It's just really hard when you are like selling like one and done, tops down, like payroll system and HR. You know, there are just some tools where they don't have a land and expand motion. There are just some tools where it's like, it's this, it's not, no one else is running like a secret payroll. Like it just is what it is. If that's what people's background has been historically, at least, those tend to be really hard pivots into this world because it just doesn't play like that 90% of the time.
Yeah. And that comes back to talking about at the very beginning of the episode, right? Like, of playing to your strengths. And on the conversation of reps, something that I've spoken to a lot of folks about, particularly in kind of sales-led motions. And so I'm fascinated to hear from a product-led perspective.
Yeah.
And especially as it sounds like you're using data kind of throughout your go-to-market motion. What are your top performers doing that put them kind of above like 100% of quota attainment versus, so the folks that are at great versus those that are at good?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things, right? I think the first one is, not that I have any of these folks here at this point, but I think one of the things that can happen in PLG is that you get, I call them like toll booth salespeople, which probably dated now. I don't know if there's even toll booth people anymore, but the idea of you've hit that limit and it's time to upgrade. And so it's kind of like, here's just a contract, send it back. We need to have a very cursory conversation. And I think sometimes that can create bad habits where you go into the place where you no longer even bother doing a discovery. You no longer bother having those conversations and doing the research on the account because you're relying exclusively on the fact that they have hit some kind of limit and need an upgrade journey. And I think that is, you know, not just a PLG problem, but it is very much emphasized in PLG because of the nature of when you get contacted and why. And sometimes, candidly, the customer doesn't want to talk about anything. They just want to be unblocked. So it is a hard one. But I would say the folks who don't fall into that habit, who even when those are the moments that someone's contacting you, they've still done research on that account. They've still gone and looked at not just product usage, but any other insights in the product usage and who they are on LinkedIn and all these other pieces, they don't forget the fundamentals of the sales process. Because ultimately, it's a hybrid. It has to be a hybrid. You can't just like forget the pieces you knew as a salesperson. So the folks who succeed are the ones who do that, who still, even though it is in theory going to be an upgrade because someone's coming in, they don't stop the conversation there. And those are folks who then get bigger deals, who get stickier deals, who get higher win rates. And it just helps them and it helps their CSM counterparts when those deals come down the line to them. That's like the very consistent patterns I see.
And so the obvious follow-up is, well, knowing that, how do you share that? How do you coach your team, those folks that maybe aren't doing that? How do you instill those behaviors, knowing this is what good looks like and this is what you need to be doing to really push yourself above the level that you're at the minute?
Yeah, I think I've been fortunate to have really strong sales leaders on my team as well who do, I mean, just to be honest, right, the majority of the heavy lifting on these things. But I think one of the themes from a good sales leader who's running a strong team is decoupling your quota attainment from your performance. And I think a lot of times those things become intrinsically tied, right? You'll hear, at least I've heard reps say, but I hit my quota. So why are you giving me feedback? Almost like insulted that they're getting coaching or feedback because they've hit their quota. And it's like quota and your performance, quota and your improvement, growth, those things can be isolated from one another, right? Obviously, if you're missing quota, the emphasis is very much going to be on the performance. We're going to be having that conversation. But even if you hit it, there's still things like even if you win the Super Bowl, even if you whatever, the coach still gives feedback to you. And so making sure that we've created a culture where it's like quota is a piece of the story. It's not the whole story. And making sure we celebrate when folks not just do that, but do those other pieces that we talked about as well.
Yeah, I love that. I'm fascinated because you kind of touched on it earlier, but want to explore it a little bit more. What is a initiative or a project that you or your team are working on right now that you're particularly excited about?
I think there's two things we're working on right now that's exciting to me. One is continuing to take advantage of these product indicators and this data for us to get more and more insights and better pipeline in for our teams. And so we have a lot of strong early indicators on it. It's a big project. It involves a lot of people. We're not done. I think there's a lot of exciting thing that's coming with that. The second one would be really leaning in to our ecosystem and to our ecosystem partners. So whether there are tech partners like our HubSpot partners, ActiveCampaign, Salesforce, Zapier, those folks, or our channel kind of reseller partners, like folks in those ecosystems, right? Salesforce has an ecosystem, HubSpot has an ecosystem. I'm leaning into those because I think there's a huge opportunity where everybody in that kind of three-legged stool, they're all trying to find things that help make their customers stickier, who help make their customers happier. And they are often leaning on trying to find that throughout, not just building internally, because also most companies at this point are doing more with less. They probably have smaller product and engineering teams, smaller sales teams. And I think there's this real moment of the ecosystem right now that's coming from that I'm really excited about Typeform and my team leaning into. So I would say kind of those two are really exciting for us right now.
Just a quick reminder, and then we will be right back to the show. At Revenue Insights, our goal is to share how top-performing revenue leaders build predictable, efficient, go-to-market teams. Every week, we speak to the brightest minds, and every quarter, we release the latest findings from our analysis of billions of dollars in pipeline. If you don't want to miss out, sign up to our newsletter at ebster.com/newsletter-signup. That's ebster.com/newsletter-signup. The link to make that a little bit easier for you will be in the show notes of this episode, wherever you're listening. See you there.
I've asked this question to a few folks and something along the lines of partnerships keeps coming up. So
yeah,
there's definitely that trend there. But I think to your point, with smaller teams and often running much leaner motions, and it's often one of those that businesses were often investing in before. And then when coming to look at, okay, you know, if we do need to make cuts, what are we cutting? It's, I think a number of businesses that I've spoken to, it's all of a sudden like, hang on, we're actually getting a really good return on that. We just haven't really been investing in it beforehand. It's not costing us a lot, even though it takes it a while to really start to see a positive return on it. When you do, all of a sudden, it's like, wow, this is actually, the potential growth is then quite exponential.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's a long going back to the question you asked earlier around like, how do you justify ecosystem and channel is one of those that's a little bit harder initially, because like you just said, it's a long tail because you're setting up a go-to-market motion at scale with people who aren't your employees. And so you have to like get them excited. You have to enable them. You have to do all these pieces. But if you do it right, it has a huge payoff long-term for you. So that's one of those examples where you have to kind of paint the vision of where it's going and what that investment is and look for those early indicators as many times as you can leading up to it. And it's not for everybody, right? Not every business, I think, can lean into that. Not every company is naturally a good fit to be in that environment. But if you are, it's really usually worth the time and energy.
Absolutely. And I suppose I want to ask one final question, and it is the bit that you alluded to earlier. What role, if any, is AI playing within kind of the internal teams at Typeform? Is it something that you're experimenting with, something that you're really seeing getting value from?
Yeah.
Would love to know.
Yeah, I think there's so many interesting places for AI to play. I think most people would say they haven't quite figured out exactly where it's at. For me, I find the most interesting part in kind of that data aggregation and easy insights. Because I think, at least from my perspective, even when I've had really big RevOps teams and data teams, there never still seems to be enough people around to give you the insights that you want to have. And data, even if everything's in Looker or whatever, it's still really hard to self-serve ultimately. And so to get to a point where you can have easy natural language questions being answered. So whether it's saying, hey, where do I find this? And it being a Slack bot that finds it in Notion for you, because there's a struggle to get that for search from an enablement perspective, whether it's being able to ask a question about what the mix of your prospects look like and provide those insights, whether it's those prompts for a sales team, hey, you should be looking at this, this, and this, amplifying scoring. I think those are the places. I don't know if this will be a hot take or not. I don't personally like it as much for trying to replace what I think humans are best at, meaning like writing an email, being in a chat, like those pieces. I think still people, there's like, for me, I'll go on an AI rant now. Like, I think there's still an uncanny valley where like, even when it gets really close, you still know something is naturally kind of wrong with it when you're looking at those. And I think that's where people are still the best. Where people are not the best is analyzing large data sets. I think that's where it's actually very, very interesting and very insightful. So that's where I'm leaning on it for my teams. I even think about with Typeform tooling, when some of the stuff we're doing, we see millions of forms. And we know which forms get the most submissions. We know which ones have the highest completion rate. We know which ones have the highest engagement. Using AI to look at the form you just made and give you recommendations based on what we know are the best performing insights, for me, that's really interesting versus it being like a chat bot, which who knows where those will go, where it's trying to answer that. But I think the data insights, I think the recommendation, I think the getting you started, that's the stuff that's really cool. And that's the stuff that I couldn't tell you, well, I've, 500,000, these are the best performing things. It's like, I don't know what those insights are.
Because I suppose in theory, you spoke of all the zero party data that you have.
Yeah.
You got all of these signals that are flowing into like your product qualification scores. And certainly, I don't think we at Ebster are quite at that level yet, but certainly something that we are looking into is how to take all of these disparate data signals that are leading into your sales process and into your revenue. I suppose in your world, it would be understanding, well, which of those are having the greatest influence over what we're ultimately closing. So of those questions that you're asking when people are filling out originally, what's the correlation there? And I think that areas like that are some of the most exciting areas for AI, right? Because to your point, I don't think it's necessarily about efficiency per se, although it does have that benefit, but it's about how to make you be more effective. How do you spend your time more wisely?
That's right. And it's an important nuance, right? Because efficiency could be getting through a lot more, or efficiency could be not engaging with some pieces so that you can give better attention to the right pieces. And I think that's where we're at. Like, we've actually done a big reduction in the number of leads we've been sending through the team. And post that reduction, the team has had the highest attainment they've had. And we could have resolved that by saying, hey, listen, have AI write all of these emails for us. That way we can still hit the 500 leads. But instead we said, why don't we have AI help us understand which are actually the good leads of this? And of that, we only take 100 leads and 100 are worked really well. And so here's AI being used to increase efficiency, but with two very different approaches. And I think ultimately I'm biased, but I think that approach of saying have the person do less and have it still be a person doing it is the better way. And having AI be the filter is what will, I think that's the places it's going to win.
How did the sales team take that when it was, by the way, guys, you're going to be getting less leads, but the good news is we think you're more likely to close.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, I will say this, I think salespeople know when they're chasing stuff that is not a good fit. And there's a balance, right? Because like not everything should be a great fit. Like that's, again, coming back to the human, like that's part of your job is making something that's not a guarantee become a closed deal. But there's also things where it's like, this is never going to be a fit. And you just making me work this lead to cover an SLA on this lead is a waste of everybody's time. And so I think there was a little bit of the team saying, hey, yeah, we know some of this stuff isn't a good fit. It would be good for you to filter it out. And then part of it saying, hey, why don't we just hire more salespeople to get through it? So I think that's the eternal battle. At the end of the day, I think hopefully you build enough trust with your sales folks where you're like, why would I have to own your number too, right? The company owns your number. Why would we set you up to be unsuccessful? Like, we'll be watching it. We'll make sure it'll turn out. And I think making sure there's always that feeling of mutual buy. And like, if they don't make their number, I also don't make my number. Like, why would I set them up to fail? Like, what is the logic of doing that?
It sounds like change management is actually pretty straightforward for you guys in many respects, right? Because it does ultimately roll up to that. So that about brings us to time, Kristen.
Sure.
Thank you so much. And thanks so much for sharing about some of the inner workings of Typeform. For anyone that's been listening that perhaps has any questions and wants to reach out, where can they find you?
Probably the easiest is just find me on LinkedIn, send me a note, happy to respond. And yeah, I think that's probably the best place.
Amazing. I will include that down in the show notes below. Kristen, thank you so much again. It's been an absolute pleasure. And to everyone listening this week, thank you. Catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to Revenue Insights. If you want to learn more, subscribe to our newsletter and we'll deliver every episode straight to your inbox. If you have any questions, feel free to connect with us on LinkedIn. Our links will be in the episode notes. See you next week.